We've been talking about the subject of sin. The doctrine of sin is a part of the larger discussion of theology that we've been doing for a while now, and so we are in the midst of a discussion of this theological topic called harmartiology. Harmartia being the Greek word for sin, so harmartiology being the word that we use for describing this particular subgenre of theology. And we've been working our way through it, and last week we talked about the curse that came upon Adam and Eve and the serpent, Satan, for their sin in the garden. And that curse extends itself into reality in this world. And we began talking about something called original sin. So who can tell me a definition for original sin? What is original sin? Correct. She's reading my own words back to me. It makes it easier that way. And if you want to know how to get a gold star, that's how you do it. You just read my words back to me or just say them back to me. It's fine. Original sin, the sinful state and condition in which all men are born. Peccatum originale, what we are by virtue of what Adam did. And the effect that is had. The curse with a capital C goes out to the whole world. It is not just limited to Adam and to Eve and to the serpent, but it has now come upon all of what God created. And so original sin is this doctrine that what Adam did as the representative of a race, we call him the federal representative of a race because he stood in the place of humanity. His obedience would become all man's obedience. His disobedience would become all man's disobedience. As the federal representative of the race, now appearing in the nature of all human beings that descend from him. So original sin. And it's a subject, as I said last week, you really have to understand in order to understand the doctrines of redemption. To understand what it is that's really going on in Christ, you need to understand this doctrine. As I pointed out last week, there's a great number of people today who call themselves Christians who have no knowledge of this doctrine whatsoever. It's almost as though the church gave up talking about it 50 years ago, and you've had two or three generations of people who have grown up never heard of it. Well, I would argue you have to know what this is in order to truly understand what it is that Christ has done. If you want to have a doctrine of redemption, which basically says that Jesus loves you just the way that you are, and that he's just your pal and your friend, then you don't need to understand the doctrine of original sin. But that is not Christianity, and therefore to have that particular view of redemption is to have a substandard view. It is to have a view which does not, in fact, save, and it is a view which is, in fact, quite heretical, to be quite frank about it. So we need to understand this doctrine well. Underneath the doctrine of original sin are two primary categories that we need to discuss. I mentioned them last week just by virtue of introduction. Anybody remember what they are? What are they? Original pollution and original guilt. All right, so let's talk about original pollution first. As I said, original sin is sort of an umbrella term over the top. It basically is just the general idea that the curse made an effect. But let's talk about the actual effect. What is it that actually took place in terms of humanity as a result of what Adam did? That's the two categories to talk about, original pollution and original guilt. Now, what is pollution? Just in a dictionary sense. A contamination, okay? What else? Is it a good contamination? No. Pollution has, by definition, a negative connotation, doesn't it? It's a contamination that is negative, harmful of some sort, right? When we think about pollution in the ecological sense of the word, we think of substances that enter the water or the air that harm it by adding something to it that makes it dangerous, potentially even deadly, right? I mean, there's some cities in the world where breathing the air is almost deadly due to what is contained in it. So pollution is the concept of the introduction of a foreign substance which makes the original substance harmful. All right, and that's the meaning that we're using here when we talk about original pollution. What's the contamination that came into the world as a result of Adam's sin? death. Death is one, what's another? Ultimately, we could argue that that's the consummation of the pollution, although decay, evil, separation from God, suffering, sin itself, the actual acts or transgressions of the law. Yeah, all kinds of things that are polluting the world, okay? So original pollution, as we would understand it, has two sides, all right? I want you to think about these two sides. When we talk about pollution in this case, we talk about the entrance of a foreign substance, basically sin and evil, into the world, and it produces two specific realities. One, the presence of an unrighteousness and the presence of evil, positive evil, okay? So the pollutants, in a sense, are unrighteousness in a general sense, evil in the larger sense. Remember the difference between sin and evil, right? Sin being specific acts or transgressions against the law, evil being the sum total of all of those together. So evil is the conglomeration of all of individual sins. An individual act is sinful, it becomes evil as a part of the larger picture of you. Okay, so that's what's being introduced into the world. When Adam disobeyed God, he introduced sin as a foreign substance into the nature of the human race. He polluted human beings with sin. He polluted himself, and he polluted all who will follow after him as a result. So two things are now true. All human beings are conceived and born as sinners. They're conceived and born as sinners, and all human beings will sin because of this corruption of their nature. They cannot avoid it. So they're born with a natural state of being sinners. What's the word for the study of being? Ontological. There's an ontological reality. Human beings are born ontologically as sinners. We are sinners. And by nature, we will sin. Both of those things are true. That's the pollution that has come into the human race. And it produces two primary results. Number one, there's a loss of innocence inherent within Adam as one created in the Imago Dei. Imago Dei being what? What is the image of God? I'm not looking for a list of them. I'm looking for a definition of it. What is the image of God in us? His communicable attributes as they are given to us by virtue of being created in his image. So when he breathed into the pile of dust, he placed those God-like, let's put those in quotation marks, God-like attributes into us. So now we can give a list of things like that. Intelligence, wisdom, will, emotion, language, sentience, conscience, ethics, morality, culture, art, creativity, inventiveness, and the list goes on and on, right, of things that are a part of us as a unique creature created by God. The loss of innocence, then, inherent within Adam, is within the Imago Dei. Within the Imago Dei, this corruption has now landed. In other words, all of the various aspects of the Imago Dei that were in Adam were corrupted, polluted. So now we could take that list and we can go back through it and say, okay, everything that God put into Adam as God-like has been messed up, right? Okay, we don't think the way we ought to. We cannot use the full capacity of our minds, right? I mean, psychologists say we use maybe 15% tops of our total synaptic ability. We don't emote well. I mean, our emotions run away with us sometimes, and sometimes they control us in ways that are unhealthy. Our wills are clearly corrupted, right? We don't make the right kinds of choices. In fact, what kinds of choices do we often make? Better word. Sinful. We often make sinful ones, yes. So everything about us is corrupted in the Imago Dei. So the pollution that we're talking about has come into the very essence of what it means to be human. We were created unique from the animal kingdom in that God breathed into us and gave us certain attributes that come directly from His nature into us, made us unique amongst all the animals, and guess what sin did? Messed with that very thing, which made us unique. That's where the pollution itself resides. And there's that loss of innocence inherent within Adam. When he was walking around the garden prior to the fall, he possessed all of those attributes along with, of course, the innocence of him using all of them in a way that glorified God. He was able to glorify God in all of who he was as a creature because he was not polluted by sin. But every subsequent generation after that has been polluted. Probably one of the greatest examples of this, or maybe not an example, but an analogy, is have you ever noticed how no matter what human beings invent, someone will get around to using it for evil purposes at some point? No matter what it is, someone will eventually use it for evil purposes. That's how it works. Everything will eventually be corrupted. We've never created anything perfect that's never been touched by sin. Everything in this world has been touched by sin. So there's a corruption of every aspect of the Imago Dei. So that's the first result. And the second result then of this pollution is this. The presence of real sin and unrighteousness. Okay. This corruption of the Imago Dei is not some sort of neutral or theoretical corruption. It is a real corruption, which in itself creates or causes all men to actively pursue what is contrary to God's law. So it's not a passive corruption or a neutral corruption in the sense that, okay, the child is born, he's born, you know, beautiful and innocent, quote unquote, right? And we all know in our hearts that this child is a wonderful looking thing, but what do we also all know? He's going to at some point look into his mother's face and say, no. It's going to come a time when Rosemary can speak, and guess what she's going to do? She's going to say, no. She's already doing it, right? Exactly. We know it, okay? So in other words, there's never a hope that any single child born is ever going to somehow not do that. That's an active corruption. Not just a passive one. It's an active corruption. It's a very real sense that all men are going to pursue what is contrary to God's law. And what Paul argues in Romans 1 is that what this corruption actually does is it leads all men in one specific direction. All humanity is led in one specific direction. And based on your knowledge of Romans 1, can you tell me what that direction is? Correct. We already said that. Well, yeah, that's the same thing. And what is that? That would be a result. So that would be a result. Yes. Okay. But what's the direction that all human beings are going, according to Paul in Romans 1? They're going their own way, which is what way? Away from God. All human beings, this reality, this pollution in the human race causes all men, according to Paul in Romans 1, to want to go in the opposite direction of whatever direction God says to go. I mean, it's almost as though God says go right, and every human being goes, I'm going left. And Paul states that in this way. He says, for what can be known about God is plain to them, that is, to those who are rebellious against God, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And by the way, that's an exhaustive list, by the way, the Apostle Paul, right there, of everything God created in Romans, in Genesis 1. Right? Look at the list. Images resembling man, birds, animals, creeping things. Everything. So in other words, where do men go as a result of this pollution? They go exactly the opposite way of God. See, what the pollution does to the Imago Dei is it corrupts it to the point where the image of God in man no longer makes him want to be like God, but rather to be unlike God. They want to go in the opposite direction from God. They don't want God in any sort of way. I mean, don't be surprised by a world full of people who hate the idea of God because they don't want a creator establishing a law over them. They want to be able to do what they want to do, no matter how ridiculous it is, and no matter how preposterous it is, and no matter how self-destructive it is. I'm going to do this because I now want to be God. In fact, it's precisely the truth when Satan said, "Eat from the tree and you shall be like God." The difference is that you'll be a false God who will stand and think that you're actually God. And so you'll make your own stuff. See, you'll turn and be a creator. But instead of creating what is good, you'll create just images. Just images. It's like the old joke where God said, I will pay a bounty to anyone who can form something unique. And one man said, I can do that. I can make something unique. So the man stands before God and God says, okay, go ahead and make something unique. The man bends down to get some dirt and God says, wait a minute, that's my dirt. Get your own. See, we think we can create. We cannot. We can fashion, but we cannot create. This presence of real sin in us is leads us away from the pursuit of righteousness to substitutes. Okay? And let me remind you here that it is a mistake to say that we are sinners because we sin. Okay? That's a mistake. We're not sinners because we sin. Nope. We sin because we are sinners. Our nature leads to our behavior. Not the other way around. We don't become something because of our actions. Our actions come out of what we are. We are sinners, born as corrupted, polluted sinners, and therefore everyone will sin. This is why it doesn't surprise us when the 2-year-old sticks his hand in the cookie jar at the express denial of his parents' wishes. Because this is what he wants to do. Okay? We are born as sinful and prove that when we sin. In other words, we just prove what we are as soon as we sin. Okay? So this is original pollution. Original pollution is a sense in which we have been corrupted in every aspect of what we are. Now let me just pause here for a moment and just put a brief parenthesis right here. Okay? And that brief parenthesis is the difference between pollution, original pollution, and total depravity. Is that the pollution is the nature of what we are. Total depravity is a spiritual result of that, that we'll get to when we get to the discussion of total depravity. So do not confuse pollution with depravity. Total depravity means we've been corrupted in every sense. But that corruption means, in total depravity, that we do not possess an ability to generate our own righteousness. Okay, so hold that thought. We'll come back to depravity. I want you just to stop at this point and recognize human beings, by virtue of what Adam did, have been infected with a pollution, a foreign substance called sin that has invaded every aspect of what we are. Which is why we need for Jesus to redeem every aspect of what we are. Okay? The second aspect of original sin then is something called original guilt. And I would argue that most Christians today would agree with just about everything I just said about original pollution. They don't really have a problem with that. Sure, we've all been corrupted. Right, we don't have a whole lot of ability. A lot of theology today would argue that we still possess some ability to respond to the gospel. Remember, I talked about the various kinds of responses to original sin that we saw amongst Catholics and Pelagians and semi-Pelagians and so forth. But most Christians would agree that there's some level of pollution within us. But now when we talk about original guilt, this is where the wheels come off the bus. Okay, so now let's talk about probably, you can disagree with me if you want to, but I really think this is probably the most difficult theological concept for modern day Christians. Okay? So here we go. Original guilt. Let me just put it before you first, okay? Just get the shock value out of the way, and then we'll move along to describing what I mean. When Adam disobeyed God's command, he not only corrupted all of humanity with a pollution, but he made all humanity guilty before God. He subjected humanity to his own guilt and the resulting condemnation for it. So we can say, on the one hand, yes, all human beings are born sinners. They possess a natural inclination to sin, which they will and prove that they are sinners. But they are also born guilty before God. And just as an aside, I would point out here that even if that 2-year-old child didn't sin and then continued not to sin at the age of 3 and 4 and 5 and 8 and 12 and 50 and 85 and then died never having sinned, he would still go to hell. Original guilt is what has happened to us. We have not only been polluted, but we've also been declared guilty by God. Now see the shock value of that? Why is it that most people say, I can't believe that? Because it's not fair. Why is it not fair? Ah, very good. Adam did that. I could not. Okay. Let's go to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 is the quintessential passage on the doctrine of original guilt found in the Bible. It's one of my favorite sections of Romans and one of my favorite sections of Scripture because it answers a lot of questions. In the book of Romans, Paul uses the term law in 3 different ways. One way that he uses it is the law which is inherent within us by virtue of the fact that we've been created in the image of God. We call it the inherent law or the natural law, sometimes the way it's put. An inherent law is a law that we just understand is true simply because we're created in the image of God. The original pollution is not completely destroyed. It's polluted, but it's not completely destroyed. Our sense of reality when it comes to right and wrong. We know. We don't need to know which Alabama code tells us not to commit murder. We know it's wrong. I mean, we know it's wrong to take out a knife and stab somebody with it. We just know that's wrong. We don't have to have it told to us. It's inherent within us. It's the inherent law of God. That's one way that Paul uses the word. The other way, of course, that Paul uses it, which is quite familiar, is the specific law given by God to the Israelites at Sinai. The Mosaic Law, right? The Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, along with a whole lot of other laws that were specific to Israel, laws regarding morality, as in the Ten Commandments, laws regarding civil actions in terms of your relationship to one another in Israel as a people, as well as ceremonial laws related to keeping the feasts and going to the temple and all those kinds of things. Lots and lots of different laws. Many of them specific to ancient Israel, particularly those last two pillars, the ceremonial and civil laws, because they were given to a specific society. There's an undergirding of a moral code underneath all of it that cannot be abdicated because it's inherent within the very nature of God himself. But it's codified in Sinai. God gave to Moses 2 tablets that he walked down from the mountain with, and then he got mad at them because they built a calf and he threw them at the calf, and God eventually wrote some new ones and replaced them. They put them in the ark. Okay? So there's 2 kinds of law. There's a 3rd way that Paul uses the law having to do with how Israel itself has interpreted the law over time. Let's just put that one aside and forget about it for now. Let's just use these 2. The inherent law, the natural law that exists within us, and the specific law given at Sinai. Okay? Who can tell me how many years it was between Adam and Sinai? How many years? Well, it's at least 600 years between Moses and Abraham. That's at least 600, right? And probably another 500 or so between Abraham and Noah, at least, depending on how we read the various genealogies in the early part of the book of Genesis. So we don't really know, right? It's really kind of hard to say because we don't really know exactly. But if we do the genealogical work, there's probably a couple thousand years, just conservatively speaking, between the time of the giving of the law to Moses and the time of Adam. And I'm just being very conservative because we know that the law of Hammurabi was written somewhere around 3500 BC. That's 1500 years before, that's almost 2000 years before Sinai itself. Okay, so it's a very conservative number, right? Okay, a couple thousand years of time. So between Adam and Moses, what law had God given to the people of earth? None. Except for one. Correct. But he gave that one to Adam. It's extended out. But was there ever really a codified law system anywhere between Adam and Moses? Had God ever spoken and laid down a system of law? Yeah, okay, the Code of Hammurabi, but God didn't give it. Where'd it come from?
We're talking about the law from within, and that would be the law.
That's it. That's the only one, right? The only law we have between Adam and Moses is that first law that I talked about, the inherent law. That's the only one. The natural sense within humanity that killing people is wrong, stealing their stuff is wrong, right? That's inherent within us. Okay, that's the only law that exists between Adam and Moses. Okay, there's no formal law given in there. Now, listen to what Paul says in Romans 5, starting in verse 12. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, who's the one man? Okay, just as sin came into the world through Adam, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Pause. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. Sin indeed was in the world before the law was given. When was this? When was this period of time in the world before the law was given? Somewhere between Adam and Sinai, right? Because that would be prior to the law. If Paul's using the term law here in that codified sense, he seems to be, right? Before the law was given. Okay. So, but sin is not counted where there is no law. What does he mean by that? Well, if you don't codify a law, what's missing? Well, what you don't have is any specific, I'm sorry, there's no specific punishments or judgments established, right? If there's no law, there's no punishment established, right? That makes sense? There's no law code. There's nothing God has never spoken and said, if you do this, then this will happen to you. There's none, nothing there, okay? But notice what he says in the next verse. Yet, death reigned from Adam to Moses. Death reigned. What does reigned mean? Has control over. Which pretty much means everybody died. Okay, so here's what Paul goes after. Paul says, between Adam and Moses, there's no codified law. And yet, people were dying in that period of time. So the question naturally is, why? Why were they dying? Is it because they themselves sinned? What's that? Guilty of what? But they're guilty of no codified law. You're getting way ahead of me. Quiet down, Roger. He's got the right answer, just the wrong timing. Okay. Is there any particular law that people were breaking? Let me ask you a question. All right, think about this now. There are only two times in the entire history of the Bible prior to the giving of the law of Moses that God gave capital crimes. That God listed capital crimes. Only twice. Can you think of what they were? There are only two times in the history of humanity prior to Moses. Okay, so you've got to spend a little time in the book of Genesis in your mind, right? Only two times that God listed a capital crime, meaning a crime that was punishable by death. That's a capital crime, right? Only twice. Nope. Did Cain die for killing his brother? Eventually, but was that specific punishment laid upon him? Nope. When he did, but there's no indication that he ever exercised it, right? Okay, what do you mean by the flood? But he never actually called that a capital crime. He just said, I'm going to wipe out the world. So he killed them just by virtue of his desire to do so. However, you're close. Now, there's one that's obvious that should be the first one that comes to your mind. If you eat from the tree that I have forbidden you to eat from, you shall surely die. Okay, that's a capital crime, right? Adam committed that crime, didn't he? How many others did? How many other people committed that crime? Well, only one if you count Eve, but we're really only counting from Adam. So Adam's really the only one that committed that crime. Could anyone else ever commit that crime? Why not? Because they were banished from the tree and they were not allowed to return to it. Thus, no other human being could ever commit that crime. All right, that's one. There's one other, and it comes after the flood when Noah and his family come out and God says, you know, you used to eat all the plants, but now I'm going to let you eat animals too. With one exception. There's a certain animal you're not allowed to eat. Well, no, you can't eat the animal with the blood in it, but there's a specific animal that you're not allowed to eat, and that's other humans. No, it's not a weird area. It's what God specifically said. I give you all things to eat, except you are not allowed to eat other human beings. In fact, if you kill another human, you will die. Right? Didn't he make that a capital crime? Remember when he said, by the blood, how did he say it exactly? He said, yes, it has something to do with blood. Okay, here it is. 9:6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So God says, that's a capital crime. Murder, technically, is a capital crime. From God's perspective, all the way back to the flood. I realize modern day America has pretty much gone to God in this regard. But this is the only, there's only two capital crimes in all of history. Prior to Moses. Okay? Okay, so I want you to make this connection. How many people who lived between Adam and Moses died? Except one, Enoch. But that's a pretty good percentage, isn't it? So we could say 99.9999999% of all the human beings born between Adam and Moses died. How many of them committed a capital crime? How many committed murder? Very few. A few, right? I'm sure there were a few, and so there were a few who deserved to die. But what percentage is that? Probably very small, right? In terms of the vast number of human beings, the vast majority of human beings did not commit murder, and so that's a very tiny fraction, okay? Now, what's my point? My point is simple. You have only two codified laws in the entire history of the world prior to Moses that were capital crimes, meaning that if you sinned, you died. And yet, everybody died. So in other words, what Paul is arguing is the point that you made a minute ago. Why do everybody die? That's it. See it? Paul's argument is, listen, you may say it's unfair that God would declare us to be guilty. But the fact is that all evidence points to it as a reality. There was a whole period of human history where there was no capital law established that that every single human being broke. And yet every single human being died. Why? Paul argues, because there is guilt that has come to all humanity. There was only, human beings weren't dying because of something they did. They were dying because of something they were. They were guilty. They were guilty of having broken the law of God, any part of it. They were vicariously included in Adam's sin. Remember, he was the federal representative of a race. What he did would have impact upon everyone who would follow him. When he ate from the tree, he was polluted, and everybody below him was polluted. When he ate from the tree, he sewed fig leaves together to cover his shame because he became guilty. He felt that guilt. He knew he was guilty before God, and he gave that guilt to every human being that would follow. The right answer to the question is because all human beings possess the natural guilt of Adam's sin. As the federal representative of the race, Adam brought his own guilt upon the entire race when he chose, for all of us, to disobey God. Human beings die not because of their own sin. Oh yeah, there's a lot of circumstances where they do stupid stuff. I mean, the Darwin Awards prove it every year, right? There's people who do things, they're sinful and stupid, and they kill themselves. But that is not the reason that we die. We do not die because of our sin. We die because of our guilt. Because of an inherent guilt within us as part of the race. Now go back to Romans 5:12. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man. Okay? Sin came into the world through one man. That's the fundamental building block of harmartiology, right? And so death spread to all men because all sin. Now, many would read that and say, well, what Paul means by that is everybody sinned. Therefore, everybody dies. And then notice the pause. Paul goes, wait, let me explain what I just meant, what I just said. See, it's not because of we sinned. We sin because we demonstrate that we're sinners. Okay, all sin. So he pauses, and then he says, for sin indeed was in the world before the law, but sin is not counted where there's no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was the type of the one who was to come. In other words, it wasn't a capital offense like his was. There's a lot of sin going on in the world, but it wasn't a capital sin. It was just ordinary, everyday breaking the law of God, the inherent law of God. But it wasn't under some actual codified law system. So Paul, with that little dash there, just before verse 13, pauses to say, wait a minute, let me make sure you understand what I just said. Death is in the world, not because all sin. We sin because sin is in the world. Death comes into the world because we're all guilty. When Adam sinned, he made every single human being guilty. There's no innocent person. Correct. Nobody escapes the inherent guilt or the inherent pollution, which leads inevitably to sin. But death itself is the result of the guilt, not of the pollution. Although one could argue it is the result of the pollution as well, because remember, both terms fit under original sin. So there's no such thing as innocent people. This explains why babies die in the womb before they ever get a chance to commit an act. Because if in fact we were dying because of what we did, then little babies that didn't do anything could certainly not die. And yet they do. In our day, at the hands of murderers. But you know. Now, many deny the doctrine of original guilt because it appears grossly unfair. All right, so let's pick up Debbie's argument here. Okay, so there's a whole lot of people who say, that's not fair. I don't want to believe that. In fact, I think that's the primary reason why original guilt has fallen out of vogue amongst believers, because in our highly narcissistic, individualized American culture, Western culture, you can only be guilty for what you have done. Which ain't true, by the way. You can be guilty for what somebody else has done. We call it the accomplice law. You can be guilty by association. So even that's false in Western law codes. But nonetheless, that's how people argue. Oh, that's not fair. It's not fair for me to be held guilty for someone else's sin. To be judged and penalized for what someone else did is unfair. I should only be held accountable for my sin, not what Adam did. Okay. So how do we deal with that? All right, let's deal with that. It's a fair objection. So let's deal with it. Number one. Would it be true to say that God is perfectly just to do whatever he wills with the human race? Now, wait a minute before you answer that question. Be aware that not everybody agrees with that. Okay, remember, there's a lot of folks that are basing their argument against this particular idea on the idea that I cannot be held accountable for what someone else does. Therefore, my will and my desires must supersede God's. You see? You see, God might have the right to do whatever he wants to, but not with me or my destiny. You see, this is where most of the theological wheels come off a lot of this thinking process of our day. It stops short of, well, God is sovereign, but only up to a point, right? Well, that's ridiculous. Either he's sovereign or he's not. Okay, so the biblical picture is certainly that God could just say, listen, I don't care whether you think it's fair or not. I'm declaring you all guilty. That's what I'm going to do. And he has every right as the creator to do that, right? Which is precisely what he's done. The good news is he's done it for a reason.
Determine what is just and what is not just. Do I get to do it or does God get to do it?
Only the just one gets to do it, would you argue? But there's a lot of folks walking around thinking, I get to make those judgments, okay? Secondly, it is perfectly clear, as we made the argument up above, that death came from Adam even down to the innocent. There's no way you can think historically between Adam and Moses without coming to the conclusion that people died for some reason other than having broken some capital law. There wasn't any. But they were still dying. So you have to deal with that. Why? Why is it that they were dying? Well, the reason is pretty obvious. They were guilty of something. But there's a most important argument here that we have to consider, and that's this. This guilt must be imputed to us as the results of our federal representative. It must be. All right? Now follow my logic here. When we talk about imputation, you're familiar with this word. To be imputed with something, okay? To be imputed means to have the assignment of a value to something by inference from the value of the products or processes to which it's connected. Now, that's complex. Okay, let me explain what I mean. To be defined with a certain value, either positive or negative, as the result of someone else's value. So either you have an inherent value, but someone else has an inherent value, or something else has an inherent value, and it's imputed to you, meaning that the value of that has been assigned to you. That's imputation. Okay? In this case, Adam's guilt was imputed to us. It was given, it had a value, it was put upon all humanity by God. He was the federal representative when he committed his act. God said, not only it belongs to you, but everybody that follows you in posterity. So all human beings have imputed with this. As he sinned, he imputed his own guilt to all who would follow after him. He doomed the race of humanity because of his own failure. Thus all men are vicariously guilty. They haven't engaged in the activity. They didn't do what Adam did, but they were there, in a sense, vicariously doing the same thing. They were doing the same thing. They were vicariously participating in what he did. Now, how do I know that? Because all those people from Adam to Moses died. Such it is with Christ. In reverse, all who belong to him through faith are vicariously righteous. Not having earned the righteousness of the cross, but having imputed to them. Okay, see, the imputation aspect of the righteousness of Christ is that we don't possess a natural righteousness. We cannot create one or earn one. So what do we need? We need one imputed to us. In theological circles, we call it an alien righteousness because it's not ours. It belongs to someone else. It's an alien guilt, It belongs to someone else, but it's been imputed to us. Okay. So what Christ did can be imputed to us just as what Adam did is imputed to us. So let me put it to you in the squarest terms I can. Any failure to accept the imputation of guilt from Adam implies an inability to accept the imputation of the righteousness of Christ. If you deny having been imputed with the guilt of Adam, you are denying having been imputed with the righteousness of Christ. Which is the reason, by the way, in case you haven't figured it out, why it is that most Baptists have denied the doctrine of original sin. They don't believe in imputation of righteousness anymore. Where does their righteousness come from? What they do. Well, I know I'm saved because I was baptized. Or I prayed a prayer. Or the pastor laid his hands on me and popishly declared me to be a Christian. It's not a righteousness of Christ. They've abandoned the idea of imputation. Thus, they've abandoned the other side of the equation as well. Okay, so now read with me Romans 5, 18 and following. Therefore, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men, right? We've already discussed that ad nauseum. One sin led to condemnation, pollution and guilt. So one act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all men. Now, what Paul means by all men, of course, is those who belong to Christ. All men who belong to this Christ. It's like all who belong to Adam are imputed with his guilt. All who belong to Christ will be imputed with his righteousness. And to make sure that everybody understands it, Paul repeats himself in the next verse. For as by the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience, the many will be made righteous. See it? What Adam did led to guilt. It led to condemnation. It led to death. What Christ did leads to righteousness and justification, life and glorification. You cannot have one without the other. A theology, a system of theology that's not built on an imputation of guilt has no way to say Christ's righteousness is in me. If you're not willing to accept the imputation of guilt, then don't come and talk to me about the imputation of righteousness because you deny it. If you deny one, by definition, you must deny the other. Or you have a very difficult time reading Romans 5, 12 to 21. You don't need it. Well, fundamentally, that's what most people are saying. They don't need it, but so they don't know the gospel. They don't really know what it is the gospel is doing. What Christ accomplished as the last Adam is to do what the first Adam failed to do. The first Adam made us all guilty. The second Adam makes us all not guilty. And the very definition of justification is to be declared not guilty by God. He declared us all guilty when Adam sinned, right? The only way we could all have this is when God declared it. It has to be so. I give you all those people who died from Adam to Moses as my proof, and so does Paul. They all died for some reason. And now those who come to Christ have a not guilty stamped upon them. Justification, we call it in theological circles. In fact, that's what Paul is arguing in the previous chapters of this letter, that justification is by faith. But what is this justification? It's the exact opposite of what Adam did. Paul's point in Romans 5 is to say, wait. Justification is about you being imputed with a righteousness because you were previously imputed with a guilt. So you need to be declared not guilty now in this Christ. So all the world stands before God guilty. And all humanity will be judged guilty before God, regardless of what they've done in life. It's not going to matter what they've done in life. They will be judged for their works. But you know what their works demonstrate? Their works demonstrate who they are. They will stand before God and God will show them all the things that they did. And all the things they did will simply prove the point. That's all. And so all men, regardless of their status, no matter how good they were, how moral they were, how religious they were, you know, how all the various, you know, how benevolent they were, you know, that won't matter. No, that'll matter because fundamentally they're guilty. They're already prejudged coming right out of the gate. So all humanity goes and stands before God, and God declares them guilty just by virtue of having been born. So we need to be born again. See, all these things fit together if you start thinking about them. They all fit together. Why do we need to be born again? Because the first birth was an utter failure. We need a new one. And this time we need to be born in Christ, a different race. A different race of people that now are not guilty anymore, but rather are righteous because his innocence has been imputed to them. His righteousness has been imputed to them. See? So you got to understand this doctrine of original sin to really get what's going on in the gospel. If you don't, the wheels are going to come off somewhere. Okay? So I hope this helps to you to think about what it is that Christ really did, because without him, we're guilty. Without him, we're guilty.